I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which culminated in a rally at the Lincoln Memorial on August 28th. The final speaker on that hot day was Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who brought the crowd to their feet with his I Have a Dream speech. Today, that speech is considered one of the great, if not the greatest, pieces of oratory of the 20th century. And while the soaring rhythm and language of the final few minutes are the most recognizable and most memorable, the more scripted beginning of the speech details the indignities of segregation and discrimination faced by Black Americans and the unfinished promise of the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, today in Radio Times, the message and the rhetoric of Martin Luther King's speech, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Kevin Johnson. He's the fifth senior pastor of the Bright Hope Baptist Church at 12th Street near Cecil B. Moore Avenue in Philadelphia. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. And Kevin Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Glad to be here today.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is John McWhorter. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He specializes in language, contact, and change. He's written a number of books and is a columnist for Time Magazine and contributing editor for The New Republic. And John McWhorter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Kevin Johnson, if I can begin with you, and I have to say, I re-listened, like many people, to the speech, and I reread the speech as well, and it seems like it's two speeches in one. The very beginning of the speech I've seen referred to as, I have some demands, and then the part we remember is, I have a dream.
Yes, I think people really need to understand that the March on Washington actually had an agenda. We actually refer to it simply as the March on Washington, but you got to add a few more words to it. It was the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. And when you look at the beautiful plan that Bayard Rustin and A. Philip Randolph put together, they had a 10-point demand that they were asking of the President of the United States, that they were asking of the United States Congress. And so when you look at the first part of Dr. King's speech, which we really don't focus on, that's where you begin to see the demand. He begins to talk about poverty. He begins to talk about the shameful condition of African Americans, and really just poor Americans, period. And he lays out the case in the beginning, talking about Abraham Lincoln and the fact that in 1863 that the slaves were set free. But then he says 100 years later, the Negro is still living in a languished position. And so what I like about this speech is the creativity of how he really hits America, the country, hard in the first part of his speech. But then when you get down towards the end, it becomes more celebratory. In the Black church, we call it, it was a close. It was a celebration. It was the happy part. But sometimes you miss the important meat of it because that was at the first part of the speech.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the meaty part of the I Have a Dream speech. John McWhorter, how do you see this speech? And then I do want to play something from the very beginning of it.
Well, you know, I actually see that speech as something to celebrate because it shows what we did. It shows how much Black agency created, how much Black power, as it was just beginning to be called then, created in terms of fixing the situation the way it was before. And I feel like, I mean, not to put words in anybody's mouth, including yours or even mine, but I feel like what we're supposed to see, especially in the first half of his speech, is we're supposed to see that we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And I think that what people often mean by that is more that we have a long way to go than that we've come a long way. We're not even at the halfway point. Mm. And I listen to the first part, and I think to myself, wow, we have come a long, long way, because I think we've gotten even more than anybody like Rustin or Randolph or King or John Lewis or any of the other people who were participating in the movement that they would have ever expected we would have gotten, even in this non-post-racial America. And so I have always read the first part of it and thought, wow, you would never know that so quickly we would have gotten so much of what he was talking about. And then I have to thread my way through the fact that I think for a lot of people, they listen to the first part and they think, and look at how long we have to go, not that much has really changed.
Well, let me play a section from the very first part of the I Have a Dream speech. And this is when King makes note of a promissory note. Let's listen to this section.
The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society. and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
And that's from the very beginning of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And then he goes on to say, but we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. Kevin Johnson, it's interesting to use this sort of promissory note, bank check, bank and justice as a kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, it's a powerful metaphor. And I think what Dr. King was trying to help people to visualize, especially when you think about it from an economic standpoint, is that the people who were there, they were coming to the place where you think that you could actually receive something tangible. And also I want to share with the listeners that we have to also look at this in the total context. You know, I'm a student of history, and it was in April of 1963 that Dr. King was arrested in Birmingham, and where he wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail. And so there were a series of events that led up to the March on Washington for Freedom, for Jobs and Freedom on August 28th, 1963, that really had a total impact upon what was happening in the nation. And I think that led to King really saying, look, you know, we believe in the Constitution. We are patriots just like anyone else, and our country has let us down.
As a linguist, John McWhorter, what do you make of that section from the speech?
Well, as a linguist, I think that it's quite beautiful. I think that it's a wonderful thing to, when you're communicating with a large audience, especially in an emotional context, to use sentences that are short and pithy and to pause in between the way he does. He's using the fundamentalist preacher tradition, which is usually associated, I think, with black preachers, but it's also used by white preachers, especially in the South. And it's a form of articulateness. There's a reason why this speech is so famous, and I think that it's only 60% the ringing cadences of the empire that we hear so much. All of those things were very well put. In my more, let's say, piquant hat, not as a linguist, but as a commentator,
yes,
I hear the part about the check, and I think, yeah, and eventually we were paid. We got quite a bit, and nowadays I think many people think, well, we're still getting this check marked insufficient funds. I think that our problems now are different. In terms of the Constitution and in terms of asking white America to pay us, there's one issue that I think is absolutely crucial, and that is young black men and the police. And I'm, of course, saying that today within a context that we're all aware of. I am very much on board about that. But beyond that, the problems that bedevil black America, I have lost sight of how we can look at mainstream America and, as Dr. King appropriately did, say today in 2013, you guys are still on the hook. We're looking to you to fix it. He said that, and he was quite right, because he was speaking at a time when if you went to an airport, you would barely see any black people there. This was a brutal nation. But 50 years later, the problems are there, but they're different. So I have an ambivalent feeling about hearing that passage now because I wonder how people hear it today.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, Kevin Johnson, let me quote something that you wrote in the Philadelphia Tribune. You say, today the problem with the efforts to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington is not that we lack eloquent and gifted orators, but rather we have no unified and clear agenda for our gathering.
Yeah, and I still stand by that. I mean, when you look at the March on Washington celebration that took place this past weekend, and even with President Obama and Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter going to be there on tomorrow, the question is, why are we having these events? It doesn't mean that we don't need them. I think that we do. I think that when you look at what took place this past weekend, there really was no purpose other than to commemorate. And as one person said to me, I don't even think that Dr. King would have shown up on Saturday because Dr. King was not someone who wanted people to focus solely on him. He wanted the issues that were prevalent and that were impacting people's lives to be there. The fact that when you look at it in 1963, that the unemployment rate was 10%, but yet here it is in 2013 that the unemployment rate is just shy of 13%. That is an increase. And instead of people out there talking about that there is a disparity between unemployment and the black community, unemployment in the white community, we were just out there just to be celebrating. And for me, that was problematic because every march that you have, it ought to have a purpose, ought to have an agenda. I mean, even when you look at the 1963 march, 2 months before it took place, John Kennedy on June 11th, 1963, introduced his civil rights bill. The march that we had on Saturday and the one that will take place on tomorrow, the president is not introducing any jobs bill to help urban America, which could particularly help African-American community. We're just really allowing him to get a pass. And so I think the issues are still there. I think the real reason why we're not really articulating them is because the president happens to be African-American.
Well, I want to pick up on that. But let me toss something to you, John McWhorter, about a minute before our first break here. But and no one really knows the answer to this question. Do you think Martin Luther King would even have been invited to this week's celebration, knowing the kind of message that he was giving in 1963?
Yeah, and I think that if King were alive today and still working, then as far as jobs would go, he would be teaching black America how to take advantage of vocational education and community colleges, which Barack Obama has made at least some gestures towards giving extra money to. I think that our answer is not to seek a jobs bill. I think our answer is to do the best for ourselves within the context that we've got. And I know that King would understand that. The model has changed.
Now, I disagree with you. King would not be trying to encourage people to be vocational. He would be expecting people to break through barriers. So I totally disagree with you on that. I do think that President that Dr. King would also be just challenging President Obama as well as any leader. Corporate America. I mean, you have to look at what really led to Dr. King being assassinated. It was what took place there in Memphis, Tennessee. He was fighting and protesting against those who were not receiving the right wages. And we can talk more about it a little bit later.
We will indeed. And that's Kevin Johnson, who joins us along with John McWhorter. We're talking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. We are deconstructing portions of that speech and talking about its meaning then and now and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Keswick Theater supports WHYY. Coming to Glenside's Keswick Theater, French comedian God Elmaleh on September 12th. German singer, songwriter, and star of Das Boot, Herbert Grönemeyer, Sunday, September 15th. Fran Healy and Travis perform on September 19th. And Hugh Laurie and the Copper Bottom Blues Band explore America's musical roots on October 25th. Tickets and info at keswicktheater.com.
3, 4.
We asked for your songs and you sent them.
You've got a deadline and I've got two headlines.
We promised you mixtapes and we made them.
We're having fun in high school.
Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen join me to reveal the winner of our Battle of the High School Bands. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
The high school.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Thank you.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, historically black colleges have been hit hard by the recession. We'll speak with the president of the Student Association at Howard University about the challenges his school faces.
The future of Howard is, I think, very, very solid. But we see these challenges as opportunities.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Tomorrow, as we all know, is the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. He delivered at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963. Our guests are Kevin Johnson. He's the fifth senior pastor of Bright Hope Baptist Church that's here in Philadelphia. He's also a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. John McWhorter joining us by telephone, associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Specializes in language, contact, and change. He's also a columnist for Time Magazine, a contributing editor for The New Republic. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we've been playing some selections from the very beginning of King's speech, which often doesn't get talked about. And here's another section where he talks about the urgency of the moment. Let's listen.
It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
And again, a selection from Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And John McWhorter, if I can go to you, right before that, he talks about the fierce urgency of now, a phrase that we hear today. He talks about the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. What do you hear in his words from that portion of the speech?
Well, in terms of the gradualism, the idea is that there were people back then who thought, and there are people who think now, that there shouldn't have been a civil rights revolution, that really we just should have waited and went slowly and not rocked the boat. And as far as I'm concerned, even if somehow that would have worked if we had waited 50 years, it was time to really break the patterns. But in terms of the urgency of the moment, I want to backtrack very briefly. I think that it's very important to realize that vocational education and two-year programs that allow somebody to make a middle-class living working with their hands, that is not a backwards thing. That is a very urgent thing to offer to somebody who has grown up the hard way and grown up with disadvantage. I think that Dr. King would understand that it's disempowering to tell somebody who's grown up hard that what they should seek. And even if you put it in that way, you know, call it breaking barriers, to tell somebody you have to get a four-year bachelor's degree when really, more urgently, you want to be able to make a living doing something that you can learn quickly and make a decent living doing. I think that's a really progressive message for the black community, and that's the sort of thing that I find myself thinking about when King talks about urgency and how we're not just going to sit, that we're going to actually do things that help people in the here and now.
Well, Kevin Johnson, I'll give you a chance to respond to some of what John McWhorter was just saying. Go ahead.
I think those are John's feelings and how he feels. I do not see anywhere in Dr. King's messages where he's advocated for vocational careers.
I don't mean that specifically.
Yeah, but I understand the point you're making, but I don't think that's Dr. King. I think when you look at this whole year, 1963, from Dr. King being arrested in Birmingham to President JFK giving his introduction of the Civil Rights Bill to the March on Washington, it was in 1963 that Dr. King published his book, Why We Can't Wait. He was not saying why we can't wait for vocational jobs. He was saying why we can't wait for justice and for economic opportunity to come to the African-American community.
But, you know, and let me read something actually that Lyndon Johnson said at Gettysburg. This was on Memorial Day, May 30th, 1963. And this is President Johnson. He says, 100 years ago, the slave was freed. 100 years ago, the Negro remains, 100 years later, the Negro remains in bondage to the color of his skin. The Negro today ask justice. We do not answer him. We do not answer those who lie beneath the soil when we reply to the Negro by saying, patience. I mean, in many ways, he was saying what King was saying several months later.
Yeah, I mean, but that is the story of African-American people. I remember Thurgood Marshall right after the decision regarding Brown versus the Board of Education. The judge said that we will proceed with all deliberate speed. And Charles Ogletree captures this in his book. And he said that Thurgood Marshall asked one of his aides and said, you know, what does the word deliberate mean? Young man went and grabbed the dictionary, and it meant slow.
Slow speed.
Slow speed.
But you know something, Marty, I think something else to think about, though, and I always think about this. I think partly because I was born in 1965, and so I always think of that year for a very random reason. But imagine the difference between 1965, or if we will, 1963, and 1973, especially if you lived through it. But even if you didn't, like me, if you can look back on feeling it as a small child, or even if all you know is pictures, or even television, the world in 1963 and the world in 1973, Petticoat Junction versus Maud. Think about what a different world it was. And so much of that had to do with how quickly things finally started to happen after so many years of stasis. And King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had so much to do with that. And it's easy to think now that he just made some music. I think that that's what it's easy to think, especially if you're particularly young now, because you just see the clips. But really, those people did such hard work, and they had no reason to think they would ever bear fruit for so long. And finally, it did. That speed from the 60s to the 70s has always impressed me because it finally happened.
Mm. Well, let me throw something else in, and I'll toss this out to you, Kevin Johnson, which is that also in 1963, you've got Bull Connor.
Yeah.
You've got those shocking but now famous photos of people being hosed in Birmingham and the dogs. Medgar Evers is killed that summer.
That's right.
There's the bombing in Birmingham shortly after King gives his speech where the little girls
die.
And, of course, then John F. Kennedy killed it shortly
and
thereafter.
I think between the speech kind of, it was some energy, but then when you see these young girls who are killed in a church, we're not talking about in a stadium, in a church, a sacred, holy place. And then when you look at a beloved president, JFK, killed in Dallas, Texas, I really think that that started to really impact America, because you have to understand, I mean, Kennedy was young, handsome, had a beautiful family, had charisma, a great orator. And I think for really the larger community to see the president of the United States killed. And the reality is it had a lot to do with the fact that there were many who felt that he was, quote, a nigger lover. And so you have this president being killed. And I think that that really started the momentum, because everybody knows that LBJ, I'm from Texas.
Yeah.
He was not necessarily a friend, but I think that moment moved things in an expedited way so that you could have legislation in 64 and 65, which then began to move the ball so that when you get to the previous, the latter decades, that we really start to see this movement. And it was great. And trust me, I think it was phenomenal. But I think that we have kind of become at ease, as the scripture says, in Zion, because we think that we have achieved so much, but there's still more that needs to be done.
Marty, may I interject a little bit?
Of course.
Pastor Johnson, actually, I politely disagree with that analysis. I see where you're coming from, but I'm not sure Kennedy's assassination was as important in the trajectory as the fact that, of all people, Lyndon Johnson, and you say he wasn't a friend, and certainly he wasn't. It's interesting seeing how he felt about what he would even call the niggers as he grew up. How that changed once he became president, where he made that civil rights bill happen against massive, massive opposition. It's almost hard to believe that this Southern white man, who wasn't really a friend, had so much to do with making all of that happen in a way that you would never have expected. And I've always found it as kind of symbolic that even him was turned around by the events that had happened, particularly in 1963 and even before. It was a real change. And, you know, I remember when Hillary Clinton got in trouble for saying this, so I suppose I'm not supposed to say it either, but a very white man had an awful lot to do with the freedom that we got. And I just think LBJ deserves his credit there.
I don't disagree. Trust me. I'm from Texas. I grew up in Austin. I've been to the LBJ Library. I mean, I get it. But what I am saying is that LBJ was not someone who necessarily would have done it if there had not been all of these other factors that preceded.
I agree.
That's all I'm saying.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and that's Kevin Johnson. He's the fifth senior pastor of the Bright Hope Baptist Church here in Philadelphia. He's also a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, joining us by telephone. But, John, you did grow up in Philadelphia, right?
I did.
Okay. John McWhorter, associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, the author of
Mount Airy. Yep.
Mount Airy, there you go. An author of a number of books about language. He is also a columnist for Time Magazine, a contributing editor for The New Republic. And we are deconstructing Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech delivered 50 years ago tomorrow at the Lincoln Memorial, as we all know, and talking about civil rights then and now, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9444. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get a caller in before we go back to the speech. We have Barbara from Germantown. Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about using the speech for teaching. I attended the march with people from the Unitarian Teens in 1963. And I'm going tomorrow, but I retired as an English teacher from the A. Philip Randolph Technical High School.
Sure.
The speech is so rich in every kind of literary device, alliteration, imagery, personification, metaphor. It starts out with an allusion to the Gettysburg Address. So you use that with students and teach them what the word score means, and then do the math and talk about Lincoln or King. Starting out saying 100 years ago, or 5 score years
sure,
ago.
Sure, sure.
Then 4 score year and 7 would take you back to 1776, and there were even students at one high school who didn't know why the Sixers had that name.
Well, that's interesting.
The basketball team. But the other allusion was that King used was Shakespeare, the sweltering summer of our discontent, which referenced the winter of our discontent from Richard III.
Well, you know what, Barbara, let me take your point, if you don't mind, and I let me give John McWhorter a chance to respond to your comments about his use of language and borrowing from Shakespeare, borrowing from biblical references. Can you speak to that, John?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that these days, I did a book that was kind of about this a long time ago. These days, we've lost oratory in many ways. We don't teach young people how to make a statement in public. We're not an oratorical nation. And I think that if you're going to teach people how to do it, you don't want to play them some ancient speech that, you know, William Jennings Bryan made, you know, Abraham Lincoln, fine. But if you want it to be relevant, I think there's no better way to teach people how to get up and make a point effectively than to use King, because it's about issues that concern us all, even when we're children. And I think that we're a nation that in many ways responds more immediately to brown oratory than white oratory, and that's a whole other subject.
That is.
And King was very much the master. So if you're not going to use Barack Obama, and I think he does it well too, I think that King is a great reference point for that.
Well, you're a pastor, Kevin Johnson.
I mean, I think that everything that John said is correct. The beauty of Dr. King's speeches and his words is, one, he was well-read. You can see it. It exudes from everything that he says. But the other thing is, he could take something and that would be maybe for one audience not in their kind of realm of understanding, and he could make it so that everybody on a fifth grade level could understand. And so as you look at his speeches and his sentences that he uses, they're not complex. Mm-hmm. They're really simple sentences. I was an English major, so I love the orator and the way he uses them. But he'll use a word like gradualism. You know,
yes.
Who uses that word?
Right.
But then he'll have so many basic words that are there that everybody can get the picture. And so I think that was the beauty of it. And then we're not even talking about, that's just, if you read the speech, it's powerful. Right. But then for him to be able to deliver it and the traditional black church tradition makes it even more powerful. So it's the mind and the heart and the soul really coming together to speak to someone's spirit.
And when you listen to it carefully, his use of repetition as well as a way of sort of underscoring his ideas. He'll go back and repeat a phrase just to give it even that much more power.
Yes. And you can also tell his ability to feel the crowd. That really is what makes a speech so powerful, is that the person delivering the speech is in tune with the person who is listening. And so you know when to go high and when to go low and when to be repetitive and when to make the point that you're trying to make. And Dr. King did it so brilliantly.
Well, you know, it's interesting, John McWhorter, because we're hearing from a lot of people that went to the marches. Many people in the back of the crowd never heard the speech. I mean, you know, they don't have the big jumbo cameras or screens and loudspeakers everywhere. And the people in the back, way in the back, I guess, because we're talking about more than 200,000 people, they didn't get to hear what he had to say.
You know, it's funny that you mention that, because that's one of those real life aspects of it that I think we have to remember. That really happened. You know, you see it in black and white newsreels, and it might as well have happened 400 years ago. It looks like a different world. People are wearing clothes we wouldn't wear. I think it's important to seek out the color photographs of it, right, to think about the fact that it was hot. People were sweating and watching this. They actually got that many people there, and things that majestic were actually said, and some people, because of technology, couldn't even hear. It was a real thing, and we should remember that 50 years later, too.
I mean, John is right. I mean, I know we're talking about the speech,
yes,
but it just amazes me that Dr. King did not break a sweat, as hot as it was on that day.
Trick to that?
I mean, I can preach, and it's AC blowing. I'm still sweating.
We'll have to get to the bottom of that. But and this is sort of a cliched question, but just to underscore the fact that he was talking about a nonviolent struggle, but not a passive struggle. I think it's important to talk about the sort of demands that he was making, but also this important message of nonviolence.
And there was, we have to also remember that there was a great fear that there was going to be this riot, that there was going to be this chaos taking place in D.C. President Kennedy had one of his henchmen there ready to pull the plug if someone said something that would lead to a riot. And I think that the power of this speech is, one, yes, the oratory, but also the message. And as Dr. King talked about the nonviolent struggle, and really when you think about it, it's easy for anyone to pick up their hand or pick up a gun and to fight, but it's more difficult for one to be taught in the tradition of Gandhi and nonviolence and to be able to accept the blows that one may send your way and still be able to stand. And I think Dr. King continued to do a great message with nonviolence.
Yeah, go ahead, John, and then we're up in a break.
It's easy to forget how counterintuitive that was, that there were ordinary people going out into the street and getting beaten up on, and that King's rhetorical power, and not to mention the institutional power of the SCLC, was such that people actually were able to submit themselves to that, which I think a lot of us would not be capable of even now. We hear nonviolence, and now it just sounds like this sort of this key word from that era, and we're used to it when we think about Gandhi or something like that. That was a really powerful way of going about what created, I'm always very aware, is my life today.
Well, we are deconstructing Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech delivered 50 years ago tomorrow. And the voice you just heard is John McWhorter. Also with us is Kevin Johnson. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. After this short break, we'll play another section from the speech. And we will also play the rousing closing section of the speech as well. So stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
PRI's The World brings you voices from around the globe.
I never felt, you know, that being Muslim and being an Indian are two different things. I can.
It's your daily source for international news and a gateway to cultures beyond our borders.
When we say somewhere over the rainbow, it's here. It's in Buenos Aires.
I'm Marco Werman. Join me right here for the next edition of The World. Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
And now, Jay Leno.
Late Night Week continues on the next Fresh Air. We'll feature an interview I recorded with Jay Leno in 1996, just before his fifth anniversary as the host of The Tonight Show. And we'll hear my interview with Conan O'Brien, recorded in 2003, when he was celebrating his 10th anniversary as the host of Late Night. Join us. This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7, on WHYY.
Nowhere to go but into a shooting war with Syria.
With this latest incident involving chemical weapons, the Obama administration is now forced to really seriously consider military options for the first time.
How seriously or how symbolically can the U.S. respond to the latest in Syria? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and tomorrow citizens from across the country will converge upon our nation's capital to commemorate and celebrate the historic March on Washington. WHYY will bring you special coverage of that event beginning tomorrow afternoon. We are talking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech today on Radio Times, and we will have our own discussion about the March on Washington tomorrow at this time as well. Our guests are John McWhorter, Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He's a columnist for Time Magazine, a contributing editor for The New Republic. And Kevin Johnson, he's the fifth senior pastor of the Bright Hope Baptist Church here in Philadelphia, and he's a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me go back to the speech and go back to a section where he talks about not being satisfied. Let's listen.
There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
And again, a section from Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. John, let me toss this first to you, John McWhorter, which is what we're talking about 50 years ago was legal segregation, legal discrimination. Mm-hmm. I mean, the things that he was describing mm-hmm. were all legal at that time.
Yep. And what strikes me about that passage, and people, I get flack for saying this, and I'm oversimplifying kind of because we don't have much time. All of what he talked about after the first sentence is pretty much taken care of, or it's become race neutral. I think we've made a lot of progress there. No signposts, all that other stuff he talked about, I listen and I think, and look, it fell away. But it's important that the first thing he mentioned was police brutality. It's not like it was in 1963, but it's not an accident that here, 50 years later, we're still sitting with that particular problem and profiling and the stereotyping. And all of that is very real, and I think that it's kind of like when a house burns down and the chimney is the last thing standing. I wouldn't want to say the house didn't burn down or that it only half burned down, but that chimney is still standing there. I think there are reasons for it, and it worries me because I think that it creates an awful lot of dissonance and it holds us back in a lot of ways. And notice, that's the first thing he mentions. And then 4 or 5 years later, you've got the Panthers, and the main thing they were about was the police. It's not an accident. So that's something that dismays me, that still the police would be at the top of the list. But the rest of it, I think we've made a lot of progress.
What do you think, Kevin Johnson?
I think that we have made some progress. There's no question about it. But I still believe strongly that the conversation of race, and I was there when President Obama spoke here, not too far away from WHYY. The conversation of race, I think that President Obama has done us a disservice by trying to bury the conversation about race and trying to bury the issues of injustice. I mean, he himself has dealt with his own issues of racism that still are prevailing. And I think that when you begin to look at the unemployment rate in the black community compared to the white community is twice as high. When you begin to look at the health care issues, it's twice as high. When you begin to look at the corporate boards are still pretty much homogeneous, all white, we still have some work that needs to be done. And so for me, when you look at it from my perspective, and I'm not looking at it from a white privileged perspective, I'm looking at it from a different perspective. You know, yes, I'm accomplished. Yes, I have 3 degrees, one from your school, John, Columbia. But the reality is that there are still some barriers. And that's why when the president spoke about Trayvon Martin, the reality is he now would not be stopped by the police because he's the president of the United States of America. But the reality is if he were not president, he may be treated just like every other African-American male on the streets of any urban city in America.
Let me go back to you, John, because I was doing some reading in preparation for the show, reading that both of you have done. And one of the things that you have remarked is not just that it seems to be difficult and maybe impossible to have a conversation about race in this country, something that has been on the agenda for many, many years now. But I got the feeling from you it's really just not necessary anymore. We've sort of moved on beyond that. Can you expand on that a bit?
I agree with that firmly.
And I'm actually quoting you there, so you're agreeing with yourself.
Okay. Oh, no, I'm not going to pull back. Okay. This idea that we need to have a conversation about race, if you translate it, what people mean is that white America needs to understand about institutional racism and inequity. And I understand why people think that, but I don't think white people need to hear that. I don't think that we need to have the conversation. One, because it wouldn't work, and we've seen that when we tried to have one under the Clinton administration. And two, I think that a lot of the problems that we have now, other than the police, with the police, I'm with everybody else, but other than the police, to say that the disparities are because white people are still on the hook is oversimplified and wouldn't really solve the problem. So, for example, talk about black unemployment. So much has changed since 1963 in terms of manufacturing jobs and where they've gone and what you need to do in order to live a middle-class life. And I think there are all sorts of reasons. One of them is the war on drugs, and there's a whole conversation about that. And I think that to say that those things are due to something that white people now are not doing, it just isn't accurate. The problems are too complicated. And so, for example, if we're going to solve black unemployment, that's why I was mentioning the whole vocational training issue. Something else that I write about way too much is the war on drugs. And I don't want to talk about this too long, but the disparities between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine that many people say are evidence of racism, the Congressional Black Caucus was right behind that in 1986. They didn't know what was going to happen. I don't think anybody did. But that wasn't racism. That was people who were trying to help save black communities and ended up not working out. So my feeling is that we don't need a conversation. We don't need America to wake up to something else. I think that the problems are such that we need to have that same strength that King urged in us to work on the new complicated problems in ways that we can actually fix things. And I don't think that waking white America up will fix things anymore.
What do you think, Kevin Johnson?
Well, I think that when you're in a position of privilege, you can say that. when you have benefited from the sweat and the tears and the backs of privilege, you can say that. When I look at America and when I look at the challenges that we continue to experience, I'm reminded of this story that was told to me when I was a student in Morehouse about apartheid. This professor said that apartheid is like a scaffold. The scaffold is used in order to build the house, and that once the house is built, you can now tear down the scaffold, which is apartheid, because the house has been built. And I think that now I'm talking. I'll let you talk. Now, I think that when we talk about the issues of race, it is still there. Jim Crow may not be there, Jane Crow may not be there, but the elements that help build it and help build the wealth in other communities is still there. And so we do have to have that conversation.
Go ahead, John.
Marty, very quickly. I'm not arguing from a position of privilege, and I think that it might sound from the very unfortunate tone of my voice that I'm saying people need to just shape up. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying about helping people in terms of employment is that it's the job of people like me, and I think people like you, Pastor Johnson, and I'm sure you understand it, to teach people what they can do and help people to do those things. But I'm just saying that those things are different from saying to white America, you still haven't done all you can do. That's what I'm saying about telling people what opportunities there are and getting them into them and support programs. So it's not a matter of me being from some position from on high because I grew up in Mount Airy or something like that. I'm not looking down on anybody. I'm right down with everybody else. But I think that we can fix the world. We can fix the problems that we have without thinking that it's a matter of telling the rest of America what it still needs to do for us. I hope that makes some sense.
Does that make some sense? And then I do want to play from the very end of the speech and get some callers in as well.
I'll let you play the next part.
You sure? Okay. We're going to have to get you two together here in our Philadelphia studios. And I do want to play the final section of King's I Have a Dream speech. And this is essentially does go off script. And it's probably the most famous part of the speech and certainly worth listening to again. Let's listen.
So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Pretty powerful stuff, wouldn't you say? I'm sure you've listened to that hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times I've delivered it, but I still get chills every time I hear it. And really, what I really hear, it's a speech, but it almost sounds like a church hymn as Dr. King is delivering with the repetition that is there. And really what he is doing is crying out in a hymn almost and urging America to help to begin to see that we are also Americans, that we are also patriots, that this is also, as he said, my country, 'tis of thee, the sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing, a land where my fathers died, a land of the pilgrim's pride, for every mountainside, let freedom ring. And so it is almost an articulation that is to everyone that we want freedom to ring. And really, because we're here in Philadelphia, it's the ringing of the Liberty Bell, even with its cracks in it. And Dr. King acknowledges all of the cracks that America has, but still says, I love this country. Mm. And I think that's the beauty, even of what Langston Hughes said, that I too sing America.
And John, you want to add to that? And we'll get to our caller, Shannon.
Just a little bit. I agree with everything that the pastor said. I think that freedom, though, is complicated. When I'm trying to teach my students what it means for people to be free, it's interesting the multifarious nature of that word. Freedom to, freedom from, freedom in whose eyes. And I have a somewhat pessimistic view of the way human societies work, where I assume that perfection is never going to happen. And so my tendency is to think that the freedom that King talked about has largely, except for the issues of law enforcement, has largely been reached, and that we're going to be free in a world where there is societal inequity, and we're going to be free in a world where there is a such thing as race bias. I may lack imagination in that, but that's the way I've worked it out over the years.
Let me squeeze one more caller, and we have Shannon from Phoenixville. Shannon, we're almost out of time, but go ahead, ask your question.
So my question is about some of the other speeches that were going on by Randolph and also by Lewis. You know, Lewis changed his at the last moment, apparently, to take out some of maybe some more incendiary language. But we don't hear so much about those speeches. I'm curious if you could comment on what impacts they had, why they were so overshadowed.
Thanks, Shannon.
Was it content or was it oratory?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I think this gets into the American folklore. We always want to hear the good things, and the reality is it doesn't matter who it is. We don't like to hear the things that are kind of sharp, that are kind of hard. And I think when you listen to the speeches of Bayard Rustin, you listen to the speeches of A. Philip Randolph, John Lewis, and even the parts that were taken out, the reality is they made some strong demands. And one of the problems with the I Have a Dream speech is the fact that it has become so commercialized until we have lost what that moment was about. And for those who lived during that time and who were there and who heard it, they did not focus solely on Dr. King. It is only now through the corporations that has become a marketing tool that we have focused solely on that. And that really, for me, is one of the pieces, even for my children, I'm trying to explain to them that there were other speeches. Right. It wasn't just Dr. King.
John McWhorter, I'm giving you the final 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Oh, Lord.
Sorry.
if Rustin had said what he wanted to say, hero that he was, there was this issue of commie baiting at the time. There was pragmatism that I think they needed to think about. And with John Lewis, again, if he had said what he wanted to say, I think the whole event would have been less effective, whether that's fair or not. And so I've always admired that pragmatism. And I think that today we need that kind of pragmatism, too. But that doesn't mean that we should forget that what King urged us to do was look beyond.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. John McWhorter, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Grew up in Mount Airy here in Philadelphia. He's a columnist for Time Magazine, a contributing editor for The New Republic. Kevin Johnson, thank you very much
Thank you, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us as well. He's the fifth senior pastor of the Bright Hope Baptist Church here in Philadelphia, and he's a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.